Coming tonight to Corinthians chapter 27, the last chapter in the book and the final study in your series. So Corinthians chapter 27 and the book chapter together. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When a man shall make a single or vow, the person shall be for the Lord by thy estimation. And thy estimation shall be of the male from 20 years old, even to 60 years old, even thy estimation shall be 50 shekels of silver, after the shekel of the sanctuary. And if it be a female, then thy estimation shall be 30 shekels. And if it be from 5 years old, even to 20 years old, then thy estimation shall be of the male 20 shekels, and to the female 10 shekels. And if it be from a month old, even to 5 years old, then thy estimation shall be of the male 5 shekels of silver, and for the female thy estimation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if it be from 60 years old and above, if it be a male, then thy estimation shall be 15 shekels, and for the female 10 shekels. But if he be poorer than thy estimation, then he shall present himself before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to his ability that thou shall the priest value him. And if it be a priest whereof men bring an offering unto the Lord, all that any man giveth of such unto the Lord shall be holy. He shall not alter it, nor change it, the good for the bad, or the bad for the good. And if he shall at all change beast for beast, then it and the exchange thereof shall be holy. And if it be any unclean beast of which they do not offer a sacrifice unto the Lord, then he shall present the beast before the priest. And the priest shall value it, whether it be good or bad. As thou valuest it throughout the priest, so shall it be. But if he will at all redeem it, then he shall add a fifth part thereof unto thy estimation. And if a man shall sanctify his house to be holy unto the Lord, and the priest shall estimate it, whether it be good or bad, and the priest shall estimate it, so shall it stand. And if he that sanctified it will redeem his house, then he shall add the fifth part of the money of thy estimation unto it, and it shall be his. And if a man shall sanctify unto the Lord some part of the field of his possession, then thy estimation shall be according to the seed thereof, and the omer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver. If he sanctify his field from the year of Jubilee, according to thy estimation, it shall stand. But if he shall sanctify his field after the Jubilee, then the priest shall reckon unto him the money according to the years that remain, even unto the year of the Jubilee, and it shall be abated from thy estimation. And if he that sanctify the field will in any wise redeem it, then he shall add the fifth part of the money of thy estimation unto it, and it shall be assured to him. And if he will not redeem the field, or if he have sold the field to another man, it shall not be redeemed any more. But the field when it goeth out, and the Jubilee shall be holy unto the Lord, and the field devoted, the possession thereof shall be the priest's. If a man sanctifies the Lord a field which he hath bought, which is not of the fields of his possession, then the priest shall reckon unto him the worth of thy estimation even unto the year of the Jubilee, and he shall give thy estimation in that day as a holy thing unto the Lord. In the year of the Jubilee, the field shall return unto him as soon as bought, even him to whom the possession of the land did belong. All thy estimation shall be according to the shekel of the sanctuary, 20 gerahs shall be the shekel. Only the firstling of the beast, which should be the Lord's firstling, no man shall sanctify it, whether it be the ox or sheep, because the Lord's. And if it be of an unclean beast, then he shall redeem it according to thine estimation, and shall add a fifth part of it thereto. But if it be not redeemed, then it shall be sold according to thy estimation. Notwithstanding no devoted thing, that a man shall devote unto the Lord all that he hath, both of man and beast, and of the field of his possession shall be sold or redeemed, every devoted thing is not sold unto the Lord. None devoted, which shall be devoted of men, shall be redeemed, but shall surely be put to death. And all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land, or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's, and is sold unto the Lord, and if a man will at all redeem aught of his tithe, he shall add thereto the fifth part thereof. And concerning the tithe of the herd or of the flock, even of whatsoever passeth under the rod, the tenth shall be holy unto the Lord. He shall not search whether it be good or bad, neither shall he change it. And if he change it at all, then both it and the change thereof shall be holy, it shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel in Mount Sinai. The Lord is speaking, and the Lord says in verse 2, When a man shall make a singular vow, And that prompts us to ask the question, when did a man make such a vow? And why did a man make such a vow? And the next step of the time tonight, here are four examples. Genesis chapter 28, verse 20, and Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way, that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God, and this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house, and the all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. That's Genesis 28. And then here is Judges 11, verse 30, and Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. That's Judges 11. Then 1 Samuel 1 and verse 11, and she, Hannah, vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid, and remember me, and will not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thy handmaid a man child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come from his head. And then finally, a verse in Jonah chapter 2, verse 9. And Jonah says, but I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving, I will pay that I have vowed, salvation is of the Lord. So we have a vow made by Jacob, and a vow made by Jephthah, and a vow made by Hannah, and a vow made by Jonah. So examples of vows in the Old Testament. He understands that the making of the vow was voluntary. The making of the vow was voluntary. There was no compulsion, there was no obligation to make a vow. But in these four cases, what we have are four individuals who anticipated some blessings, who anticipated some benefit, and undertook in response to give something back to the Lord. So, those are examples, and those are the circumstances. So the question posed by the psalmist in Psalm 116, verse 12, and the psalmist asks this question, what shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits towards me? And really that question could have been in the mind of Jacob and Jephthah and Hannah and Jonah. What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits towards me? Four individuals who anticipated some benefit and anticipated some blessing and undertook in response to give something back to the Lord. And if you read the commentators, they will often refer to Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, where Paul says to the Christians in Rome, I beseech you therefore, by the mercy of God, that you present your body the living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Romans 12. Start at Romans 1. In Romans 1, as you know, a picture of universal condemnation. And then as we move through the chapters that follow, the great truths of salvation and justification, declared righteous by God. And then we come to the lofty heights of Romans 8. No condemnation for God's people. No frustration of God's purpose. No restriction in God's power. No limitation to God's provision. And no separation from God's passion. And we come to all those chapters. And then we come to Romans 12 and touch, moved, affected by what God has done for me. In response, I have this burden, I have this exercise, I have this desire to do something for Him. Touched, moved, affected by what God has given to me. I have this burden, this desire, this exercise to give something back to Him. And so that's the idea of a vow. There was a great article in the Leaders magazine last month by Bert Cadill. Wasn't the only good article, but Bert Cadill's article began like this. In an art gallery in Dusseldorf, a well-dressed young man stood for a long time gazing on a unique painting. Deeply moved, challenged by what he saw, the painting was called Ecce Homo, it was the man. The artist had tried to depict the crucified Christ, and written beneath it in Latin, all this I did for thee, what hast thou done for me? And then Bert Cadill continued. In that life-changing moment, the young man bowed That's verse 1. In that life changing moment, the young man vowed, so think about a vow, the young man vowed to dedicate himself to the service of the Lord Jesus Christ. And then at the end of the article, a little footnote talking to Bert Francis Burley. Abigail was also inspired by that same painting during a visit to Germany in 1858, and that led her to write him. Bill King used to give out often at your conference upstairs, "Thy life was given for thee, thy blood, O Lord, was shed." So that's kind of the background. An individual who is so moved by what God has done, by what God has given, that there is this burden, this exercise, this desire to do something, to give something back. Verse 2. "When a man shall make a singular vow," and so we're calling this, first of all, tonight, grateful donation, grateful donation. Something that is to be donated, something that is to be given by an individual to God in gratitude, a grateful donation. But then secondly, we'll have to think about a grave consideration, a grave consideration. You see, Deuteronomy 23 and verse 22 will say, "If thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee. If thou shalt not vow, it shall be no sin in thee." So the making of a vow wasn't compulsory. A vow was something done out of devotion and not out of duty. But the point is this, once made, it must be kept. And so I'm reading Deuteronomy 23 verse 22, but let me read verse 21 and verse 23. "When thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it. For the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee." And then we have a verse ready. "If thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee." Verse 23. "That which is gone out of thy lips, thou shalt keep and perform, even a freewill offering, according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth." So that's Deuteronomy 23, and then we have a similar thing in Numbers 30. This is the thing, verse 1, "which the Lord hath commanded, if a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word, he shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth." So the making of a vow wasn't compulsory. Done out of devotion, not out of duty, but once made it must be kept. Ecclesiastes 5 and 5, "Better it is that thou shouldest not vow, than that thou shouldest vow and not pay." In other words, better not to make a vow, than make a vow and then break it. And what we have in this chapter is how vows were to be implemented. More accurately, more particularly, how vows were to be implemented if the person who had made the vow wanted to change his mind. Warren Wiersbe said, "If you ever find it difficult or impossible to fulfill a promise, the message of this chapter is for you." Now, we read the chapter, and as we read the chapter, you would see various categories are listed. So, in verse 9, a reference to a beast, so it's animals. Verse 14, a house. Verse 16, land, field. Verse 26, the firstling of beasts, the firstborn of an animal. And in verse 30, a reference to tithes. Go back to verse 9, and we discover that if the animal which was the subject of his vow is a clean animal, then that animal must be given. That animal, and that particular animal, must be given. Once an animal was chosen to be given to the Lord, it could not be changed. The person could not exchange it with a worse one, can't substitute a bad for a good. You can't cheat God. But he can't even change it for a better one. Once chosen, that particular animal had to be given. And if he did try to exchange it, look at the end of verse 10, both animals, both the original and the intended substitute, the king, the Lord's. So that's the case of a clean animal. But then, if it's an unclean animal, the animal which is the subject of the vow is an unclean animal, the animal must be given, but the owner could have it back. There's 12 on the payment of a price, there's 13, the value of the animal plus 1/5 more. So, clean animals had to be given, unclean animals could be bought back at the price of an additional 1/5 more. And then, verse 14, the house. If a house is to be given, should be given, it can be redeemed, verse 15, again, for a premium of 20%. And C.A. Coates makes an ecclesiastical application. He says, to dwell in a hallowed house costs something. To dwell in a hallowed house costs something, with the church truth, if there is truth there. So that's the house. And then verse 16, we come down to land. And so verse 16, you've got inherited land, some part of a field of his possession, and in verse 22, purchased land that man has bought. Land would be valued, and we regle this according to the period life until the year of the Jubilee, and then land could be redeemed, again by adding a fifth to the value, and if not redeemed, then at Jubilee, verse 21, inherited land would become the property of the priests, and purchased land would become the property of the original owner, verse 24. It shall return unto him of whom it was bought. So we've got house, we've got land, fields, and then in verse 26, we've got the firstborn, the firstling of the animals, the firstling of a clean animal. No man shall sanctify it. It could not be the subject of a vow, for it was the Lord's already. And the firstling of an unclean animal, verse 27, could be redeemed. And again, as we reference to the addition of a fifth part. And then in verse 30, a reference to tithes, a tenth of everything belongs to the Lord, and there is provision, verse 31, for redemption, again at a further cost of 1/5 or 20%. So, you know, detailed provision about different kinds of goods, and the common message is this, that it's a costly thing to break a vow. It's a costly thing to break one's vow. Once a vow is made, the person can't just try and back out and walk away. In some situations, that vow must be kept. That vow must be kept. And in other situations, redemption was possible. Redemption was possible at the value of the item plus 1/5 more. And what that meant was God would never lose out. God would never lose out. And so redemption possible in some situations, redemption possible for some particular sums. And so we're going to call that granted redemption. Redemption could be granted in some situations at a particular price. And so we have animals and houses and land and the firstborn and tithes. But back in verses 2 to 8 we have people. So look back at verse 2. When a man shall make a singular vow, the persons shall be for the Lord by thy estimation. Or according to another translation, when a man consecrates by a vow certain persons to the Lord according to your valuation. Now what does this mean? What does this mean? Well, it seems as if there are at least three schools of thought as to what this means. The first school of thought is that these payments were usual. Here's what one writer says. In practical effect, the vowing of a person to God usually meant merely the paying of a certain sum of money into the hands of the priests. People could not be sacrificed, and so their value was given instead. And according to one website, one version of the Torah, the Hebrew scriptures, goes like this: when anyone explicitly vows to the Lord the equivalent for a man, the following scale shall apply. So the first school of thought is that the usual situation was that a price was paid. The vowing of a person to God usually meant the paying of a certain sum of money into the hands of the priest. So that's the first school of thought, that payments were usual. The second school of thought is that payments were exceptional. So if a vowing had been given, if a vow had given a person to the Lord, then that should be done. And that individual should spend their life in service to the Lord. Unless, in exceptional cases, a price was paid instead. So, three schools of thought. The first one, that the payment of a price was usual. The second one, the payment of a price was exceptional. And then there is a third school of thought, and that was that these payments were additional. These payments were additional. There's a man called Andrew Bonar, who lived in the 19th century. He was a minister in, I think, the Church of Scotland and then the Free Church. He is the man who wrote Robert Murray McShane's biography. He was the brother of Horatius Bonar, the great Scottish hymn writer. Well, anyway, Andrew Bonar wrote a book on Leviticus, and in the What the Bible Teaches commentary on Leviticus, as you might know, at the start of each is What the Bible Teaches, the author, the commentator, has a wee bibliography listing books that they have found helpful, and then they give little comments on the books. So the commentator on Leviticus says about Andrew Bonar, it's a biography, a touching biography. It's thoughtful and a thought-provoking work. It's a thoughtful and thought-provoking work. Well, this is what Andrew Bonar says about this payment for price. He says, this is not an answer money. This is money in addition to the offering of the person. It is not a substitution. In other words, what he's saying is this is not money paid so that the person can go free. You make a vow concerning a person, and instead of the person becoming a servant of the Lord, a monetary price is paid instead. That's what these other schools say. What Andrew Bonar is saying is, no, it's not money paid so that the person can go free. This is money paid in addition to the presentation of the person to the Lord. In other words, not only is the person becoming the Lord, but in fact you're also paying for the privilege of that person becoming the Lord. So three schools of thought, and the answer perhaps is not particularly clear. But what is being emphasised in these verses, from verse 2 to verse 8, is the valuation. And we read all that, and you can see that there are valuations, and the valuations varied depending on the gender, and they varied depending on the age of the individual. So the valuation varied depending on whether it was a male or a female, and depended on whether their age was between 1 month and 5 years, 5 years to 20 years, 20 years to 60 years, and then 60 years and above. And in each category, each of these four categories, the value for a male was more than the value for a female. So the first category, 1 month to 5 years, it was 5 shekels and 3 shekels. In the second category, 5 years to 20 years, it was 20 shekels and 10 shekels. In the third category, 20 years and up to 60 years, it was 50 and 30. And in the final category, verse 7, 60 years and above, it was 15 shekels and 10 shekels. And so we see the valuation was lower for the very young, 1 month to 5 years. Then for the very old, 60 years and above. Then for the young, 5 to 20 years, and highest for those between 20 and 60. And so if you want a heading for all this, we're calling them graded valuation. Now, note the accuracy of the valuation. Now, we see this throughout the whole chapter. verse 20. The priest shall value, this is the unclean beast, whether it is good or bad, as thou valuest it, who art the priest, so shall it be, for my margin. According to thy estimation, O priest, so shall it be. Verse 14, in connection with the house, as the priest shall estimate it, so shall it stand. And then in verse 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8, a reference to thy estimation, thy estimation. So the accuracy of the valuation. And then we can speak about the immensity of the valuation. You know, even the smallest of those sums, and the smallest sum was 3 shekels, even the smallest of those sums was sizable. Apparently the average wage of a worker in those times, those biblical times, was about 1 shekel per month. So even the smallest sum, 3 shekels, was a sizable sum. So the accuracy of the valuation and the immensity of the valuation. And then, in one sense, we can think about the equality of the valuation. If you fell within a certain category, there was no discrimination with regard to rank or wealth. Someone has said the redemption of the high priest was precisely the same as that of the laborer. So in some senses, the equality of the valuation. In another sense, the inequality of the valuation for men had a greater value placed on them than women, and the explanation is easy. The value would correspond to their economic value. So we've got the accuracy and the immensity. In some senses, the equality, in some senses, the inequality of the valuation. But then, finally, think about the tragedy of the valuation. The tragedy of the valuation. For the price declines, the price diminishes, the price decreases after 60. And to quote Mr. Coates again, he spoke about a sorrowful picture of decline. A sorrowful picture of decline. And that's sad if that is true. So, graded valuation, graded valuation. But then look at verse 8. If he be poorer than thy estimation, then he shall present himself before the priest, and the priest shall value him. According to his ability that thou shall the priest value him. And we're calling this gracious provision, according to his ability shall the priest value him. Here are 3 quotes. Someone says, note that he is not to bring him to Moses, but to the priest. Moses is always the representative of the throne, the government, the way of God, while the priest is always the representative of the grace and mercy of God, the tender character of his love. And I think that writer maybe borrowed the idea from C.H. McIntosh, who said this: Moses is the representative of the claim of divine righteousness. The priest is the exponent of the provision of divine grace. The poor man who is unable to stand before Moses fell back into the arms of the priest. And here's quotes again. Leviticus is a book of wonderful grace. Grace comes in at unexpected places. There is a beautiful touch of it here in relation to the man who is poorer than thy valuation. If you are conscious that you are poorer than the valuation, go to the priest. So gracious provision. An individual who is poorer than the estimation and the valuation, he could go to the priest according to his ability. Shall the priest value him? So we see as we're going down the chapter that an individual could not redeem, could not buy back a clean animal. That was the subject of a vow. Could not redeem the firstborn of a clean animal, for it was the Lord's already. And then in verses 28 and 29, a general prohibition. No devoted thing shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy unto the Lord. None devoted, which shall be devoted of men, shall be redeemed, but shall surely be put to death. So devoted things could not be redeemed, for they were already under the sentence of death, and that death sentence must fall. When the chapter closes, and the book closes, in verse 34, these are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel in Mount Sinai. And you'll see that chapter 27 closes in a similar way to chapter 26. And you'll sort of wonder about the inclusion of this chapter here. And they have suggested, really, that the book could easily have ended At the end of chapter 26, and you saw that last week, warnings and curse of disobedience, according to the head of my Bible, mercy promised to the penitent. Verse 46, these are the statutes and judgments and laws which the Lord made between him and the children of Israel in Mount Sinai by the hand of Moses. And some have suggested that the book could quite easily, tidily, have ended there. And so we might ask the question, is this chapter 27, is it an appendix? Is it an afterthought? Is it a postscript? And the answer is no. And the answer is that this chapter is in its proper place. It is in its rightful place. After all that is compulsory, after all that is mandatory, what we now have is something voluntary, something discretionary. When a man shall make a vow, if any choose to make a vow. And so in chapter 27, it's not the case of an individual asking, what must I do? What must I give? Rather, the individual is asking, what may I do? What may I give? This is what Michael says. The voluntary act of worshipping God by means of vows is the highest form of Old Testament worship. The legislation of this chapter, chapter 27, assumes that men will, out of gratitude to God for his mercy and grace, make offerings which were the Israelites' response to love, not to law. How appropriate for the book of Leviticus to end on a note of love, rather than of law. How appropriate for the book of Leviticus to end on a note of delight, rather than duty. Here's Andrew Bonar again. Thus this book, the pictorial gospel of the Old Testament, ends with stating God's claims on us and his expectation of our service and willing devotedness. Now you've spent some weeks in the book of Leviticus, and someone might ask the question, why study Leviticus? Well, as you've studied Leviticus, you have listened to the words of God. God speaks and speaks and speaks and speaks. So as you've studied Leviticus, you've listened to the words of God. And as you have studied Leviticus, you have seen the Son of God. Jesus is the Son of God. And so I looked at the closing section of the commentary on Leviticus and what the Bible teaches, and it closes like this. Leviticus breathes into all who have the interest to delve into its depths the fragrance of the person of Christ. It brings into focus the worth, the amazing worth of his work and the wonder of the extent of it. And you know, I suppose even in this chapter we're reminded of the Lord Jesus, aren't we? Sad, isn't it, that, you know, God had to make provision for a man who wanted, in a sense, to be free from his vow. You know, the highest form of worship, and yet there could be circumstances when a man wanted to be free from his vow, or a man who wanted to give to God something that in fact was already God's. Sad that that act of devotion, the highest form of Old Testament worship, could be diminished by man's frailty and man's sin. And as we think of all that, are we not reminded of one about whom we sing, thy vow was on thee, thou didst come to yield thyself to death, and consecration marked thy path and spoke in every breath. Well, that's Leviticus 27. We might ask the question, where does this leave us? And maybe we should just ponder and look back in our lives and just wonder, can we think of promises that we made to God, prayers that were spoken in God's presence, undertakings that were given, and really they've never been fulfilled, they've never been kept, they've never been accomplished? That's challenging, isn't it? I love that old hymn, O God of Bethel, by whose hand thy people still are fed, who through this weary pilgrimage has all our fathers led. And verse 2 begins like this, our vows, our prayers, we now present before thy throne of grace. And maybe you like me to think on promises that were made, vows that were spoken, undertakings that were given that perhaps have not been yet completely accomplished, fulfilled, and kept. I came across this story just as we closed. After the church service, a young man approached the preacher and he said this, 2 years ago I was in Vietnam. Our company was pinned down under an enemy barrage. I was in an exposed position. Bullets were whistling over my head. Shrapnel was exploding all around me. I was scared stiff. I was sure I would not get out of there alive. I prayed. It was a Christian. Lord, I know what you want. You want me to enter the ministry. If you get me back safely, I'll start training for it. And the young man said, God answered that prayer and brought me back safely. But the story goes on that he had come back to America, left the army, went into business, started making money, started making a lot of money. But he then explained, strange things recently have been happening. Despite the general success of businesses like mine, despite the favourable conditions for business, despite everything I can do, I've been gradually losing money. In very odd ways, my business has been falling apart. Just yesterday, I lost everything. Said the young man to the preacher, I know what God says to me. He has taken me at my word. He has taken my business away. And I know what I've got to do. And the very next day, that young man went into ministry. It's always good if we keep our word, isn't it? And it's particularly good if we keep our word that we've given to the Lord. And so that's Leviticus chapter 27. We thought about a grateful donation. We thought about that grave consideration. The vows really have to be kept. We thought about granted redemption. In certain circumstances, redemption was possible, but redemption was always very costly. And then we thought about graded valuation, different ages, different genders. We thought about that gracious provision. God is always mindful of the poor. If he be poorer than my estimation. We thought about the general prohibition, the things that have been devoted, that are already the Lord's, subject to the sentence of death, and cannot be redeemed. And then we ended with that glorious conclusion. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel in Mount Sinai. So we're to be with you, and it's so nice to be with you. Our Father, we think of all that's been before us tonight, and we think of individuals in the past who made vows, and we think of man's frailty and perhaps attempts that people would make just to change their mind, just to get out of situations. And we think about our lives and think about our spiritual ambitions and aims and perhaps promises, vows, undertakings that we have made. And just long for the ability to rise to our responsibility and live for thee in this evil, this sinful world. We thank you for our time tonight. We thank you for the assembly here in our living. So we remind you of the assembly at Kirkcaldy, and particularly pray for them in all their weakness and in all their sorrow, that they might come in a mighty way and bring increase, numerical and spiritual increase. And revival. We pray for them, we pray for ourselves, and seek a parting blessing.